Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, a weekly podcast that gives thoughtful people some perspective and insight on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 6th, 2014. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific blogger, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well. Well, D.R., this was one of those enormous weeks for climate news. There's more than we can honestly talk about. But we will do our best to get to the most important stuff, right?
Absolutely. So I think all the news that's fit to print, as they say.
That's right. Of course, we'll get to the election, right? And everyone, that's the big elephant in the room. But perhaps the more important and profoundly important, more long-range topic is the release of the last of the IPCC reports, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this was this past weekend, which now I guess November 2nd, 3rd. The IPCC, which of course is a UN organization, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they released the final summary of all of those crazy IPCC reports that have been released, you know, seemingly every 3 or 4 months for the last year or so. It's a very long and slow process the IPCC goes through. But they finally released, I think, the last of the last for this current 7-year cycle, I guess they run on. Mm-hmm. And that report, it's called the synthesis report because they've synthesized all these sort of other reports we've talked about, synthesized it into one document, and then they synthesized that into an executive summary, which we'll put on the blog. But that report was somewhat sobering, right, DR? Shall I read the quotes, or do you have them in hand? I mean, what did the report say?
Well, as the New York Times reported on November the 2nd, on November the 3rd, rather, that according to the synthesis report, quote, continued emission of greenhouse gases will cause further warming and long-lasting changes in all components of the climate system, increasing the likelihood of severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts for people and ecosystems, unquote. And the New York Times noted that this is the starkest language the IPCC report has ever used to describe the threat we're facing.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems, I mean, of course, I will freely admit that I have not read even the 40-page summary in total. I mean, it's tough sledding. I scanned it. But it's a very sobering report. I mean, when you see these scientists after years of thought coming up and saying things like, as you just said, a high risk of severe, widespread, and irreversible impacts, I mean, that has to be sobering. And I guess it's a question of, you know, and again, people don't want to hear this stuff, right? The report more or less gets buried. I mean, you were saying before that this was covered on, the release of the report was covered on CBS on the evening news on Sunday?
There were two venues that covered it in terms of television coverage. PBS Weekend News Hour covered it on November the 2nd, and on November the 3rd, CBS Morning News did a great 2.5-minute segment of it. CBS This Morning, rather, did a great 2.5-minute segment on it, and the CBS Evening News led with it on the evening of November 3rd with a great 2-minute segment, very comprehensively laying out the risks that you know the world is facing, and the fact that the United States, China, and India seem not to be as aggressive as they need to be in terms of, you know, leading the world and cutting emissions. So it was very well done. Unfortunately, it didn't seem that much of the other television media seemed to be bothered in terms of covering it. But props to us, to PBS and CBS.
Well, I guess, I mean, here's my problem with, I mean, it's great for CBS to have a whole 2 minutes, even an incredibly well-documented 2 minutes. But this story is so profound and so important that the idea that, you know, we're happy with 2 minutes of coverage is distressing. And I guess the question I have is whether or not the media is collapsing and not answering the call that they have to be truthful and inform people about the facts that are important to them. I mean, we've beat up every media outlet out there to the extent we can beat them up for their lack of coverage, but this just seems to me to be the topper. Am I crazy, DR?
Oh, no, you're not at all. And there were some great stories from the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and ThinkProgress.org discussing the fact that the mainstream media largely ignored the IPCC report and that CNN, under their November 2nd edition of the show Reliable Sources, saw fit to bring on for several minutes Weather Channel founder John Coleman, who's a total climate change denier. It goes to an issue that the radio host Tom Hartman has often brought up, which is that several years ago, there were sort of various changes were made within the government and within the media culture that resulted in media being considered more of a form of entertainment than as a public service on the part of the television networks. And Tom Hartman has often
This would
noted
be the
that
fairness doctrine from the mid-80s, right?
he said the fairness doctrine was one example, but there are other various legal decisions made that had the effect of essentially breaking the concept or ending the concept that news divisions served as a public service. And in from there, by the late 1980s, news divisions fell under the auspices of the entertainment divisions of the major networks. And
And
this is
probably the
why.
art, I, if I could interrupt you, being innocent of the background of what you're talking about, but nonetheless, you can imagine an argument being made that there is so much media out there that each individual media voice does not need to be balanced, and that on average, because there's so many, there'll be a balance. Whereas prior to that, back in the 70s, for example, each individual outlet had to be balanced in and of itself. And I think that's the distinction. And that's where all of a sudden you get into the entertainment business because a company like Fox can go off and do whatever they want because they don't have to provide both sides of the story. Is that fair?
That's fair to say, but the problem is that, to amplify an argument that Naomi Klein has made, that just as the climate crisis hit at the time when world governments were least likely to respond adequately to it, this crisis hit at the same time that the media culture in the United States, definitely, and in other parts of the world, were the least likely to respond to it. We've talked before with our friend Gavin Weber about how the Australian media totally drops the ball and deliberately drops the ball in covering this issue, and we see this sort of problem manifesting itself in United States media.
Well, I don't know. I think that if I could go back to an article by Joe Rome that he published in Think Progress, it he keyed on the idea that the current IPCC summary report really does address the morality. Now, once you say morality in a scientific report, you're starting to kind of walk towards the edge of science. But basically, the argument that the impacts are so severe and irreversible, essentially unchangeable on any time scale that matters to a civilization, right? We're talking thousands of years before the system can redress itself. That essentially amounts to immorality, and that it's doubly so because while there are risks involved in continuing to emit fossil fuels pollution the way we're doing now, right? And the risk, of course, is severe, widespread, and irreversible impacts. People claim risks associated with addressing climate change, but the report points out that any risks associated with the mitigation actions that I propose, typically economic risks, are much shorter in time scale and much more easily reacted to by the society, so that we can all decide that from a millennial scale, from thousands of years scale, we could all decide we're not going to sell any more gasoline in the United States, and that would certainly throw our economy into a tailspin, but we could recover from that somehow over the course of dozens of years. Whereas the other path, the path that we're choosing, is one that creates damage that will last 10,000 years. And it's an important point to keep in mind that there's a morality question in doing things that are irreversible on timescales of tens of thousands of years. I mean, I can speak from experience. I mean, I have worked in companies that either use or emit gases, these specialty gases, right? So you take carbon tetrafluoride. That has an atmospheric lifetime of, it's a terrible greenhouse gas, that has an atmospheric lifetime of 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. So when you emit it, it's up there for 10,000 years and continuing to warm the planet. And once you start thinking in those terms, it becomes very hard to justify it. Right? 10,000 years from now is a long time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
And Rome has made the argument before about, you know, whether people, you know, the whole frog in the boiling pot argument, that at one point do people realize that they're starting to burn and get the hell out of the pot, basically.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, so if you get a chance, we'll put up links to the IPCC executive summary, which is not that long, and some articles describing the important points in it. Unfortunately, they're not particularly new points to most of the listeners of this show, right? That humans are causing climate change, it's going to get worse, dust bowls, all this kind of stuff. But it's a nice compilation, and it's one that is historically will be unable to deny the idea that people didn't know, right? You cannot claim ignorance after this kind of report comes out.
You cannot claim ignorance, but sadly, so many people do. They embrace ignorance, to use a different concept of the word claim.
And speaking of people who can say they aren't a scientist, we had another big event this week, and that was, of course, the midterm elections, which suffice it to say that climate hawks were not thrilled with the results. We can talk through some of them. But I guess I'd like to take some of the races that occurred here in Massachusetts as exemplars for other states and other places, right? So it's not inside Massachusetts baseball. It's basically talking about these things as examples that will or may happen in other states. So let's start with a bottle bill, DR. The bottle bill was a ballot question created by 100,000 signatures of people to expand the different types of beverage bottles that were to carry a 5-cent deposit, because the original bottle bill passed in the 80s was hugely successful in getting people to recycle them, or that they were not on the street for whatever reason that you can think up. That bottle bill ballot question went down to a blazing defeat by a factor of 3-1, right? 75% to 24%. So tell me, DR, what happened?
Well, what certainly happened was that it was dramatically outspent, and the no on two crowd spent something like, I believe, $8 million, largely from the beverage industry and the supermarket industry, to basically kill the bill. And it's definitely is a disappointing setback for those who recognize the merits of the bill. And it does raise the question of, you know, in a post-Citizens United era, where money is speech and money talks and you know what walks, do supporters of this sort of legislation, do they have to essentially find billionaires of their own to sort of fight off the billionaires who oppose progress? Mm-hmm. It's essentially a financial arms race that we're living in, and you see this now.
And you know who has the arms, right?
Arms, legs, feet. Fists.
I mean, for my money, the way I understood the story was the bottle bill had a something like 68% approval rating. Now, of course, most people don't think about the bottle bill very heavily. So these kind of polls, I'm sure that was a relatively soft support, and people agreed in principle last May and June that, we ought to have a 5-cent deposit. But then come the middle of August, as you said, this big money came in from the outside of the state and carpet bombed the whole idea and turned the idea of a nickel deposit on the beverage containers into a forced deposit and a form of taxation and all kinds of bad stuff. I mean, from to my mind, it's kind of an example of what this outside money can do. Is that wrong? Do you think that the bill, the bottle bill, was ill-conceived from the start, or do you think that it got defeated by outside money?
I don't think it was ill-conceived. That there are arguments on certain websites trying to push the idea that it was somehow ill-conceived, and that supporters of the bill should have pushed for more curbside recycling. But I think the bill stands fine on its merits. Mm-hmm. I just think that, you know, there are so many good ideas that just cannot survive a tsunami of spending by people who oppose such good ideas. And when that happens, again, either one throws one's hands up in despair, or, you know, sadly, it may just be a situation where you just have to sort of find your own financial sugar daddy, basically. Yeah.
Well, I guess the other question that came up that I think is interesting is the gas tax ballot question here in Massachusetts. And again, for those who either weren't paying attention or don't live in the state, the state government passed a bill where there was a increase in the gasoline tax, the automobile gasoline tax, that was indexed to inflation. So that rate would keep growing with inflation. And magically, there was a ballot question appeared out of nowhere to reverse that indexed rise in the gas tax. And of course, because there was a word tax associated with it, the question went down to defeat. And I guess for me, it's kind of a warning that in a state where you have a ballot initiative, if you hope to pass a carbon tax, which is tough enough on its own merits, but then implicit in the idea of a carbon tax is a formalized planned increase year on year. I mean, that's what makes the carbon tax work. Mm-hmm. You'd best be prepared for a ballot challenge funded by deep-pocketed opposition, and you'd better have you get yourself ready for that kind of an onslaught. I mean, the same thing that happened to the bottle bill could easily happen to a carbon tax if the Koch brothers decide that that's what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So take that as a lesson, right?
Increasingly, it's going to be a fight between good billionaires and bad billionaires,
which is a terrible thing for democracy. So then of course, in Massachusetts, we had the election of a new governor. The race was between the Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Charlie Baker. Massachusetts has a long history of electing moderate Republican governors, even though the state is largely a Democratic state. Charlie Baker won. Tell me, DR, is there any good news for climate hawks in Charlie Baker's election?
Well, there's been some speculation in that direction. There was a great piece by a Northeastern University professor named Matthew Nisbet, who talked about how Baker, when he ran 4 years ago, was doing a combination of "I am not a scientist" and "I am not convinced." But this time around, he said, "Yes, I accept the scientific evidence, and yes, I recognize the need to move towards clean energy." And Nisbet suggested that Baker may embrace a pragmatic approach on this issue. And certainly, you know, it occurred to me that, Baker is talking about sort of, you know, casting himself in an independent bipartisan tone, and sort of, you know, not trying to embrace sort of ideological crusades. If I were him, I think I'd place a call to the former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California and say, "Hey, give me some advice on how to deal with energy issues," because I think Schwarzenegger is a good example of somebody governing a blue state, not from a blue state party, so to speak, mm-hmm. but nevertheless had enormous success navigating climate and energy issues. And whatever free advice Schwarzenegger could provide to Baker, I think it would serve him well.
Yes, and we certainly wish. Certainly wish the new governor well. We hope that his comments about climate and his acceptance of the science is real. I hope that we go beyond acceptance of the science to a real commitment to doing something about it. But I guess one of the take-home lessons for me about from this election, and in fact from the election of President Obama, is that any politician, regardless of party, is only going to respond to pressure from the outside, from the voters. If you think back, President Obama was ready to let the Keystone XL pipeline slide on through until Bill McKibben and the climate hawks went and made an issue out of it. The same will be true for whoever governs Massachusetts, whether it's no matter what party they come from, that people need to make their views known and make the politicians aware of the consequences of ignoring their views, right? So speaking of ignoring views, let's talk about the U.S. Senate, which of course went to a largely conservative tilt this time. What are the implications for climate stuff in the U.S. Senate?
Not good, as you might
I'll let you
imagine.
say that, dear.
And there was a great piece by the former Boston Phoenix writer Dan Kennedy, for the WGBH News website, in which he talked about how the newly elected Senate is basically planning to wreak all kinds of havoc on President Obama's climate action plan. There's some speculation that they will try to figure out some way to essentially force him to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, that they will basically declare holy war against efforts to cut carbon pollution from power plants. However, there was another interesting piece in Roll Call magazine, discussing the number of senators who are going to be up for re-election in 2016. And if you read between the lines of that piece, you do wonder how many of those vulnerable senators will go along with actions that might imperil their ability to be reelected. We know that Senator James Inhofe, the global warming is a hoax guy, is scheduled to take over the Environment and Public Works Committee. And you do have to wonder how many of his colleagues in the Senate who are going to be up for re-election in tight races and in states where they may well lose if they go too far into insanity, how many of them will sort of join Inhofe in his adventures in derangement?
Oh boy, I certainly hope you are right that reason and pragmatism prevail. I don't know. I think that the people need to understand that the risk of the ability to do mayhem of these climate deniers that now run the Senate is the following: that when you are the majority party in the Senate, you determine what amendments can be put on a bill. And so what the plan will be is to present, say, a bill that raises the debt limit, which of course, we've had fights about in the past, and attached to that is a little thing about Mr. Obama, you will let the Keystone XL pipeline go through. So then the president is faced with a choice of a bill that he wants to have passed with this poison pill attached to it that he can't, he can't separate out. He can't reject part of the bill. And that is really where the power has shifted in the Senate. They can do that now. They can essentially defund the EPA and attach it to some bill that the president needs to sign because he is the executive of the nation. And we're in a position where there's a lot of power has shifted to the climate deniers, and it's not clear to me how this will be combated. But it really is a sobering time for people who want to see climate action, especially given the. Go ahead, dear.
There's also an argument too that things could sort of fall apart for the new Senate majority because there's a great writer named Norman Ornstein who had a piece that appeared, I think for theweek.com, in which he noted that a lot of the activists who got this new Senate majority elected are going to try to push to have President Obama impeached, that they're going to try to lobby the House and Senate for an impeachment, and that could really be something that sort of causes the new House and Senate members to sort of fall flat on their face and could cause a backlash that could definitely bode ill for those deniers in 2016 politically.
Yeah, I hope so. 2016 is a long time away, though. We need to. Well, all right. We'll get away from the gloom and doom. We'll close out our show this week by having a. I got a chance to catch up with Chris Manns, who is an activist here in Massachusetts working to reverse the terrible Citizens United Supreme Court case. That is to say, the Citizens United case was the place where the Supreme Court decided that corporations are people and money is speech. And you don't need to know much more about it than that to realize how big the implication is for the power of corporations. There's a movement afoot in the country to, because the Supreme Court has not spoken, is the only way around it is to make a constitutional amendment that clearly declares that corporations are not natural people and can be regulated and don't have free speech rights in the sense of having the right to spend money. Here in Massachusetts, there was a bright spot in that cause coming out of last Tuesday's election. So let's take a listen to what Chris Manns had to say.
So we're talking to Chris Manns, who is up here in Massachusetts and is an organizer trying to promote a constitutional amendment to change the recent Supreme Court decision called Citizens United and basically to decouple the idea of personhood from corporations. And so welcome, Chris. How are you doing?
Great, Ted. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming back and talking to us. So now we're after the big day, after Election Day. Last time we spoke, we discussed how there were cities and towns across Massachusetts who were about to vote on advisory ruling, advice to their state representatives about how they should vote. And so tell me, what happened on Tuesday?
Well, Ted, it was beyond my wildest expectations, having never done anything like this before. We had sign holders at the polls. We had people coming up to us to ask us some questions. We had people absolutely excited about this idea. The outcome in all the towns and the 18 districts was absolutely phenomenal. 68 percentage points was the lowest yes votes, and
Really?
77% was the highest. It was absolutely phenomenal.
You mean of the 18 towns that took a vote on this issue, the results ranged between 68 and 77% yes?
Correct.
That's
It was
fabulous.
such an overwhelming statement for the citizens. And I just want to do a sidebar. Residents in Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Florida that had this on the ballot in their towns, it was overwhelming everywhere. And it absolutely shows that this is not a partisan issue. It is an issue for we the people. We had people commenting, and different comments we heard by voters after they came out was one gentleman said, "For me, this was the most important ballot question."
Really?
We had a policeman who was off duty come up to our sign holder and say, "This is common sense." We had people from all political parties, people that I hadn't seen in years but recognized and came over to me. They said, "We voted yes." And I'm talking about Republicans, Democrats, independents. It was
Everybody.
Across the aisle.
That's, and so tell me, given that I know that you worked very hard to get the information out, but it seems like it's a fair statement to say that most people walked into the ballot box not having a clear knowledge that this question was going to be on the ballot, and their instinctual reaction was to vote in favor of it, that corporations should not be considered
You know what it
people.
was, I got as much as for being one person here in Franklin. I tried to get as much information out there as possible with palm cards to let them know it's going to be on the ballot. A lot of people had no idea that other than the four questions that the state put out, that there were any other questions on the ballot. And we, of course, had number five and number six. We had sign holders all day. So people would come up to some of our sign holders and say, "What's this all about?" And then once they knew, they were like, "Oh, great." So the absolute reaction to I certainly didn't get through to 7,778 voters.
Uh-huh.
So people were in the know about this issue. We did have some blanks on there because people probably didn't understand the question. But the overwhelming response kind of said it all, Ted.
That is great. So tell me, what's the next thing? So you had this big day at the polls where you had a very positive reaction to the idea of overturning the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling. What comes next?
Well, the movement, of course, starts from the ground up with a non-binding ballot question to raise awareness and act as an advisory to where voters stand.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily then the results can be used by Congress on voter opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can strongly say that the citizens across the country are making themselves heard by sending a strong message to their elected officials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now, once we have all the numbers together, the exact numbers for all the towns in the state that have voted on this, then in January, it'll go to possibly Senator Jamie Eldridge, who will file legislation to propose an amendment.
That Massachusetts would support an amendment at the federal level.
Exactly.
To the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
Super, super. Now, how can people get involved if they're interested in trying to support this movement? Here in Massachusetts, across the country, what should they look for?
Well, the follow-up now, we're going to be putting letters to the editor in precisely with the statement about this voting result. And then we're going to have a link to them on if people want to get involved and learn more. So that'll be in the local papers.
Well, that is excellent. Congratulations on all your good work. I'm sure that you'll be plugging away over the next couple of years doing the same thing. And I think it's wonderful that you had such success.
Well, what was wonderful is the reaction by the people, by what their comments were. Resoundingly approving of this. They were really excited that this was on the ballot.
That's great. Well, Chris, thank you very much for talking with us, and we will have you back again soon to hear more about Citizens United.
Thank you so much, Ted.
So there you have it, DR. That's our show for this week. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.
And we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thanks for being here this week, DR. As always, I appreciate it.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.